going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast. I am Donovan Bennett, and we're going to go deep on a couple things. It's a great time right now in sports. We've got playoff races in both the NHL and PWHL and the NBA. We're going to talk a little bit of basketball in this episode. The F1 season has started and is upon us, and Ferrari with Lewis Hamilton is always in the news, and certainly they are in the news to start the year, and we're going to tackle bit of both, but not in terms of what's happening on the court, but the storytelling around what's happening on the court or what has happened on the court and on the track. Twofold, because you know I love me a docuseries. We are going to dive into Celtic City, the 9-part docuseries on the history of the Celtics and their city, Boston, and really, quite frankly, America, and more broadly, North America. We're also going to review Drive to Survive, which is out right now on Netflix. And I would argue, since season one, the most recent season, about the 2024 season, is the best that our friends at Box to Box has produced. And the rise of F1, it's giving us not only Drive to Survive, but all of the spin-off series following sports, leagues, and teams. But also it's going to give us a motion picture. I was actually on a press call previewing the upcoming film F1, brought to you by F1 and Apple Original Films and everyone at Warner Brothers. It's produced by director Joseph Kosinski. The film is also produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. You may have heard of him, kind of a big deal. And Lewis Hamilton himself, the famed F1 driver, and a guy you may or may not have heard of who stars in it, and Brad Pitt. I'm really excited for that film. What they have done, essentially, driving race cars during the actual circuit in downtime to film scenes of this episode, building fresh F2 cars, but with capability of cameras around them to be documenting everything in real time at high speeds, is super fascinating. The trailer is out. I'll put actually the trailer into the show notes of this episode. Hopefully, as we get closer to release of that picture, which is so big, it's actually going to be in IMAX nationwide on June 27th in 2025, internationally on June 25th, 2025. Once we get closer to that, hoping to preview that as well. And maybe we'll have our guests in the back end of this show, Jonathan Brazeau, back to talk about this series. But we got to talk about real life and real stories. And I was not an F1 fan before Drive to Survive, and now I'm hooked. And I certainly have never been a Boston Celtics fan. And I wouldn't say I'm hooked, but I have a new respect for them after watching the 9-part series, Celtic City. It's brought to us by director and Emmy Award winner Lauren Stolwell. Showrunner and executive producer is Gabe Honig, who brought us the Captain series on Derek Jeter and his chase for 3,000 hits, which was real good. And then, you know, executive produced by Bill Simmons, who's done a lot with The Ringer, Andre the Giant probably being the biggest sports story, and Connor Schell, who's done a bunch, not just in the 30 for 30 space, but The Last Dance and OJ Made in America, probably the biggest titles with his name as an executive producer. This one's much different than all of those projects. Chronicles the Celtics, obviously, the NBA's winningest and most storied franchise from when it's founded to its most recent banner in 2024. But it goes into the history of segregation in America, integration in America, housing inequity, all of these big things, these complex issues, societal in the city of Boston, the United States, that really impact us worldwide. Those tensions are told through the story of the Boston Celtics. So I wanted to figure out, how do you take 75 years of history and outstanding legacy and distill that down into a story in 9 parts? So let's go deep on all things Celtic City, the HBO original 9-part documentary series with Lauren Stolwell and Gabe Honig.
The 2024 Boston Celtics are one of the greatest teams in NBA history.
We did it!
It is Banner 18.
First and foremost, congrats, because it was a great watch. And I'm going to be honest, I was expecting to watch in protest, as I am not a Celtics fan, and signing myself up for a docuseries, watching a team that I've rooted against, did not seem like fun, but I enjoyed it. And Gabe, like you did with the captain, as I was not a Yankees fan or Jeter fan beforehand, I found myself with a newfound respect for the subject that I didn't have going into it. I'm certainly, the audience of Celtics fans is going to watch and rewatch, but you're making this for a much broader audience. How did you go into the project knowing that people are going to come to the Celtics conversations with different levels of information and knowledge, but also different levels of love for the subject?
Sure, Donovan. I mean, you know, you and me both, man. Like, I was born and raised in New York and kind of, you know, in a sports-loving household that very gently, you know, bred me to just have disdain for all things Boston sports. So, like, after doing the captain, I couldn't possibly fathom spending the next 2 years telling the story of the Celtics. But, like you're saying, it's, like, it's almost instantaneous. As soon as I read the treatment and they laid out, you know, what Aaron Cohen at Words and Pictures and Lauren and her vision, like, laid out the story and how it intersected with this really complicated city that I thought I knew, I was like, man, I'm in love with this. And, you know, as a storyteller, like, I was like, yeah, sign me up for this. And I think, like, because of that angle that I was taking from it, like, yeah, it leads to just, like, leaning into the story and character. And that's always been Lauren's vision as well. And I think that's why it's resonating with non-Celtic fans too. It's like, it's a human story. It's a story about people that just happened to be playing for the Celtics in the city of Boston.
Well, it's a story about the city as well. And the preconceived notion that I came into it with was, all right, Boston is hostile towards Black people, the end. And I don't know that the series dispels that, but I think what you learn is that America at different times has been hostile towards Black people. When you look at telling not just the story of the team at any given time, but the story of the city, the country, and the era, how did you tackle the idea of jumping back and forth between those narratives in a way that makes sense and is easy to follow?
Yeah, I think, Donovan, I think it was definitely a challenge, you know. I think because, as you're saying, there's such a rich and very nuanced conversation and intersection between the team, the city, American history. I mean, we start this story, you know, in 1950 when, you know, Red Auerbach takes the job and they draft the first Black player in NBA history in Chuck Cooper. You know, they went on to have the first Black starting five, first Black head coach in North American sports history, all during the 1960s, the most turbulent time in American history. So we always saw that foundation of the organization being so tightly woven with cultural and racial progress in America. It was just a really natural starting point for us. And then we really just began to trace that lineage, to trace again, the history of America and of the city into the 1970s with the busing mandate, as you see in the third episode, and how that impacted, you know, the city, the fan base, the players, how the organization brought people together with their two championships in 74 and 76. And then thinking about, you know, Larry Bird coming after all of that racial turmoil, entering Boston and the media deeming him the great white hope, you know, and what did that mean? And how did Larry deal with, you know, that, you know, being placed on him? So it was very natural for us, Donovan. I think there were so many intersections throughout history, the Lakers-Celtics rivalry being racialized, Bird and Magic, LA, Boston, trying to debunk some of the myths, but also address some of the reality. And what, why is it, as you said, you know, Boston Globe in 2017 did a whole report on, you know, why is Boston a racist city or perceived as a racist city? And 54% of people said it was, they felt unwelcome being in Boston. We wanted to understand where that came from. So that's a very long way of me saying it was a challenge, but something that we knew inherently had to be included with all the other iconic great basketball moments.
A challenge, but one that you have a very unique and important perspective, given, you know, that you're a Black director, but also I would argue that you're a female director and that diversity is important and often not something that is able to happen in the industry in terms of filmmaking right now. Everyone brings themselves into a project, but how does your experience and lived experience help shape what this project looks like?
That's a big question. I think, you know, it's of course it's hard to you never really separate yourself from the project. It's, you know, obviously we are always trying to be objective, and you know, we went into it with a genuine curiosity about the city, about this team, about the people, you know, Red Auerbach and Bill and Larry and all of these great players we wanted to really understand. But of course, like I am very, I mean, personally as a filmmaker, I've always gravitated towards the stories that are at that intersection of our country's racial history and the progress of, you know, and the evolution of race in our country. And, you know, so many of those individuals, Donovan, are really no longer living. The individuals who really, you know, the foundation of this country, the civil rights fight and struggle, you know, Satch Sanders was drafted in 1960. He's, along with Bob Cousy, they're the only two living members of the organization, of the dynasty, the 11 and 13 years. So like being able to sit down and talk to Satch Sanders about what Bill Russell's civil rights struggle, like his desire to do more than to be a Black superstar in the league, the impact that he wanted to make. I mean, those stories are so important. So if I could bring that, you know, elevate that to the conversation, I think it was obviously elevated to everyone on our team. We all believed that those stories needed to be told, but I thought it was important to, you know, turn our camera lens, you know, on these, you know, Black superstars and their families and, you know, and tell their stories as well, because that's part of the Celtics story. So that was very important to me.
It's a beast of a project in many ways. How long were you working on it for? Because I'm going through and the producer in me is watching and saying, okay, well, that was shot in 4K and they punched in. That was SD and they made it a bit wide. That person's no longer living, so that is potentially archival footage, or they interviewed them before they died. What did this look like to get all of these people in this body of work?
Yeah, that was it was a massive undertaking. You know, it's by far the longest time I've spent on a single project. You know, it was basically two full years. We started the first week of January in 23. And delivered the last episode, I think, the last week of December in 24. And we needed every second of every day during that time. We had an incredible team that was dedicated to the cause. And, you know, people are losing nights and weekends because they fell in love with the story. But yeah, it's a lot. You know, 98 interviews, most around three, you know, average was 3 hours, all that archival you're talking about. And yeah, like, you know, we were shooting, yeah, I think we had like 50 interviews done in the first like 6 months, and yeah, constantly going back and rounds of notes. It was a massive undertaking. And I think like what I'm most proud of is like, you see it all, you see the hard work, because it just feels good when you're watching it. Like everything flows. And some of these projects, you just got to get on the air. And this one, you could just tell how much people cared about telling the story in the best way possible when you watch it.
I always, when I see a project come out, I'm think to myself, why now? And this is an ongoing story. The Celtics franchise continues to evolve, and now is recently being sold. Sometimes the answer is just there was distribution vacancy right now and interest. The Celtics helped by winning a championship, and I think I saw parade footage from that recent championship in almost every episode. But why now does this story make sense for you guys?
I didn't have as much as you know, I guess the 18th banner helped, right? And we didn't know that when we started production. But we knew that the Celtics were in contention. But I think it's like 17 championships, you know, at that point, like there are, you know, Gabe and I would always talk about, they're a Tiffany franchise. Like, you know, they are up there with, you know, the Canadians and the, you know, the Green Bay Packers and the New York Yankees, right? I mean, the Lakers have had multiple series done on the comprehensive full breadth of their organization. The Celtics hadn't. And I felt like, you know, we all felt like that just felt like a miss, like how incredible this story is. Like no one has seen this story laid out end to end from, you know, banner 57, you know, their 1957 championship to the current day. And like, I think that was like, that didn't seem that outlandish for me personally as to kind of like how or why would this be interesting, I think, or relevant now. And I think the issues of race and culture in America and kind of these difficult conversations, but important conversation and discourse around those conversations, like I just think there's a place for that right now. I think we were surprised, Gabe and I were surprised how open everyone was to talk about this stuff. We weren't even bringing it up. And, you know, writers were talking to us about the racial dynamics or tension at times through the eras. And I mean, that was a really powerful thing and important for us to present, I think.
It was the right time to tell the story the way we did. And I don't know if that's why it was greenlit. It probably helps in some way. You know, those conversations are, you know, happening without Lauren and I, like, you know, and that's okay. I think the why of it all is like, yeah, the Celtics story deserves it, especially when you see it laid end to end. And the way at times you're just like, you can't write this stuff. If someone turned the script in Hollywood, they'd say you have to rewrite it because some of it feels very far-fetched and unbelievable. And then, yeah, what Lauren's saying is 100% true. It's like telling the story right now in 2025, you can actually do it. You can do it justice, and you can tell it the way we're telling it.
I want to unpack telling it the way you did. Because I love documentary storytelling, specifically documentary sports storytelling. I fear that if we're not already there soon, the space will become oversaturated and it'll just be too much for anyone to really be able to understand and cut through and consume. There's some distinct choices with this, clearly. It is a docuseries, not a documentary. It for most people, will be viewed episodically, week by week or whatnot, and not binged at the same time, although I suppose on demand, some people could do that later. Does that change the approach for you as storytellers? Is it a necessity in terms of telling this story in the way that you did? Walk me through those choices.
Yeah, I mean, there's several factors to the choices that were made. I mean, I think the decision that, you know, HBO made to air one episode per week, and kind of leaving that week for people to think, discuss, debate, absorb. I think that does allow for these kinds of conversations, and we have been seeing a lot of that, on social media, and just as we're talking to people, that they're able to really absorb. Because from our perspective as the storytellers, we always saw this as a story that had a beginning, middle, and end over 9 hours. We never thought about it as like an anthology where each was a self-contained, one decade period that we would be documenting, even though it does structurally break down that way in a chronology that is pretty close to decade by decade. But I do think like we wanted to have themes, Donovan, like from the very beginning in episode one that you're going to see revisit in episode six and revisit again in episode eight and then in nine. Bob Cousy doesn't go away after, they win, their 11th championship. He comes back to speak about what it means to be a Celtic, later in the story. And you kind of have to have that appreciation of his journey and his contributions to really know that. We see Bill Russell thread through the entire episode. When you get to episode eight and he's with Kevin Garnett and they have this incredible conversation together, it has resonance because I think you're able to know what it meant to Bill Russell to have a Kevin Garnett who connected so deeply with the city. When Bill, as you see in our story, he never had that connection. It was strained. There were complications with his relationship with Boston. To see that payoff, 6 hours later. So again, long-winded way, Donovan, of me saying it was very intentional for us as the filmmakers to really connect those themes. There is a bigger story here. It is one collective story. And so many of these players spoke about their collective experience and harkened back to those earlier, foundational players and moments that helped impact where they were. So it was very natural for us to tell it that way.
And also the Celtics organization, like, they lean into that. And I don't think a lot of other organizations do it to the extent and to the effect that the Celtics do. Like Lauren's saying, like, Bill Russell is like with KG in 08, but he was also at practices where no cameras were around with Paul Pierce. And it's very, very few professional organizations that have that kind of lineage or allow the past to be present so much. And like Lauren always called it, the echoes of the past. And like, yeah, at times those echoes are happening, but it's also sometimes it's really, really present, the present voice. And, as we are structuring out the 9 hours, some creative choices probably would have changed if we knew everyone was dropping it all if we knew HBO was dropping all of them at once. Like, yeah, maybe the ins and outs of some of the episodes would be slightly different because there is no wait. But like, yeah, I also think that a lot would be missed if they did that. And it was awesome to see, like, after episode one drops, like there being this new conversation about how innovative Bob Cousy really was. And after episode two drops, to see this conversation about a new generation of people understanding and appreciating, the magnitude that Bill Russell had on, the world, not just basketball. So like, it is allowing a breath and allowing people to digest. And I don't think that would have happened if all nine, or they're dropping three at a time over 3 weeks, would have happened.
No matter the approach, these projects are only as strong as the subjects, giving them context and moving the story along. And often the star people are athletes or journalists, and that certainly is here. But I would argue the stars in this, in a way that differentiate it from other series, are the family members and spouses and the Boston natives and celebrities that do that. Having those reoccurring central characters allowed you to do what with this story?
I think it allowed us, every person that we interviewed especially those who are outside of the individuals who put that uniform on, the players, right? Like the supporting cast of journalists, authors, as you mentioned, family members, all of them have like a very real and important and meaningful connection to either the city or the team. And like, you know, I think even when you look at someone like, you know, a Howard Bryant, who certainly has, you know, he is an accomplished journalist who has appeared in many documentaries on many subjects, but being able to kind of turn the camera on Howard and hear his own memories of being a Celtics fan, you know, and he talked about like even the Bird era, he wasn't able to get tickets and he used to want to go to the Garden so badly, and he's watched all these moments, right? And that's just one example. Like thinking about Bill McSweeney, who co-authored Go Up for Glory with Bill Russell. He's 96 years old, and you know, he still has the original manuscript and the typewriter that he wrote that book with Bill Russell on. And like these people, that yes, they all are qualified to tell the story. They remember the iconic moments. They've, you know, worked alongside these players, whether they're family members or journalists, but they all have this like connection. There was this, you know, this deeper connection that I think that we all felt like as a team. Like we were very intentional about not just necessarily getting a quote talking head to advance our story. Everyone we sat down with, we wanted to be a recurring character. We wanted to talk to these individuals about every era of Celtics history and American history and where they intersected with it, where their perspective lied. So yeah, I think, you know, I hope I'm answering the question that you're asking, but I think that was my hope and our hope as a team.
Lauren, I have to jump in and just say like, that's a credit to you, because from the beginning, you didn't want this to be what some other sports docs can be, which is just like getting a big name to kind of talk generally about the subject matter. And instead you wanted people who were there, who can give more context, like you said, have these artifacts, whether they're real artifacts or they're living artifacts because they went through the history. And also to HBO's credit and the NBA's credit and Words and Pictures and The Ringer, Bill Simmons, like no one forced that. Sometimes you're in these projects and it's like, man, like we just need to get this superstar to talk about what Bill Russell meant to them and get that in early and often. And that never happened here. You know, it started with Lauren's vision and it, everyone just, as soon as we saw it, you're a believer in it. And I think it really works.
Anybody that you didn't get that you wanted?
Yeah, of course. Of course there are. I mean, starts with, you know, we really put the and I'll pun fully intended, the full court press on Dave Cowens. We would have loved to have added his voice you know, throughout the series, but especially episode 3. He just wasn't in the right place for him to sit for an interview with us, and just asked us to please use archival footage. And yeah, it would have been ideal to get a couple more of the Celtic rivals to give their perspective. I think Jerry West was, you know, he was really additive. James Worthy, Pat Riley were really additive, speaking about their experience as Lakers. Yeah, we wish we got a 76er to talk about that rivalry in the early and mid 80s, and to also, you know, to get a Detroit Piston from the Bad Boy days to sit with us. And, you know, those guys politely declined. For whatever reasons they had, we every attempt on our end was made. And yeah, some of the rivals didn't want to go down, you know, memory lane where, you know, they probably thought that we were going to talk only about their losses. We wanted to talk about way more than that with all of them, but it is what it is.
I have this phrase that I share with my wife when we're watching these series or working on them ourselves. And it's the producer fist pump moment where you're in the chair or in the edit suite and you hear a piece of sound and you immediately know that's Nugget is gold. I'm going to use it. What was that for you in this project?
Oh my gosh. I mean, Donovan, there were so many moments. It's a great question because there were more than just like fist pump moments too. I mean, I can think, even we were just talking about Jerry West, and I was just thinking about that day again. Some of the things that he said were just so resonant, I think, with, and we're now seeing are very resonant with the audience as well. And, you know, when he said, "I'm a wolf and you don't F with a wolf," like, I know that is maybe something he has said in the past, but I just, if you look at his face and you can see the intensity of someone who for so many years was so competitive and wanted to beat the Celtics with every fiber of his being. I mean, those are moments that you're just so, I was just so captured by kind of his, you know, his openness, his vulnerability. The same thing, I mean, it happened with Robert Parrish. There were so many moments with Robert or with Kevin, Danny Ainge, you know, Kevin Garnett, like, you know, there's just so many. I couldn't, like, you know, tell you that there was maybe like one or two. I really think we were lucky, right, Gabe? I mean, we had more sound, like, as what producers would say, like, just great bites than you could imagine. I mean, people were just hilarious and witty and, you know, honest. Yeah, I think we were really, really lucky in that sense, but we were also... I mean, we obviously prepared really well for those interviews, and our team was incredible with just the research, preparing me to go into those interviews as well. So that was always helpful.
For me, it was something that Nelson George, the esteemed writer and director, said. And, you know, just to circle back to the beginning part of the conversation, Donovan, was like, yeah, as I'm coming into it, I'm like, my own self of, you know, my own self-discovery of like, what are my preconceived notions about the Celtics and the city of Boston? And it's like, yeah, we all know, you know, I think if you know sports, you know the reputation of Boston, that it's a, you know, it's a racist city. And I was just trying to figure out why, as I was growing up, I don't know of any specific incidents that like cause that belief. And then as we get people in the chair, and people, it was incredible to me, all the players brought it up almost naturally. Before we even were going to ask them, they would bring up that perception. I mean, we just saw in episode 3 that Jason Tatum was like, yeah, the only thing I knew about Boston was the Celtics and racism. And I was just trying to figure out why. And then people started bringing up the infamous Ted Landsmark photo, the Soiling of Old Glory, where, you know, it's a Black civil rights worker being, you know, bludgeoned by the American flag that was, you know, sent countrywide in 76. And, you know, it wasn't until Nelson George actually sat there and gave the bite of, you know, because this is the thing that like really interests me the most about this project, was like, here's this organization that's super, super progressive. It's got all these firsts and it really moved sports forward and never gets credit for it because of where they play. And Nelson George crystallized it in a perfect bite, being like, yeah, once that photo went nationwide, Black folks in America were like, that's it, you know, Boston's a racist town. And it washed everything the Celtics did and we're gonna do away. And it affected multiple generations of Black athletes, is what it seemed. And for someone to say that, I remember that moment really, like, it's one of the things that stand out the most to me. I got, you know, the hair stood up, because someone just connected those two so succinctly and so powerfully.
Yeah, it was a great section of the doc that really should be shown in civics classes and American history classes, because it made a lot of sense in watching it. And I actually watched it through the lens thinking, if that happened now in this era of social media, you know, what would the response be? What would the talking points be? How, if at all, would it be different? I actually watched, to be honest, the whole doc that way. And there were so many things that made me think about the NBA and how it's changed. And just watching fans run on the court basically before the game was even over, time and time again, the fights between players, between fans. I'm just thinking, this is so far from where the league is now. What was it like for you, fans of certainly sport, but obviously knowing the league, to be able to give this analogy, this history in terms of us remembering where the sport had been prior?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was, I know from my perspective and Gabe's perspective, we talk about it so much, especially now. It was such a treat, Donovan. I mean, I think we both obviously had a great appreciation of the NBA and the league and the history. I think being able to actually see the dig through the crates of the archive and really reminiscing and kind of like being in that moment, like that, and that was a big thing. Our editors were amazing, just trying to place the audience in a time and place. Like, you should smell the Boston Garden when you're watching this footage. Like, you're talking about these fans that are running out shirtless, and there were so many cutaways that, you know, even in the black and white footage of, like, people were surprised that there were, like, women courtside, like, in full-on, like, you know, suits and dresses and, like, in their Sunday best, and they're jumping up and cheering. And, like, I think it just, we were so lucky to be able to have the canvas to be able to paint with that, you know, with the 9 hours to be able to let some of these moments really breathe. And, yeah, I mean, it was incredible to see Bob Cousy. You know, what he was an actual magician. Like, I mean, I still look at this footage. I know we're still talking about it, Gabe and I. Like, it's unbelievable. And it's kind of just been, you know, in an archive. And the fact that we were able to revive it, it was really great for me. I know for our editors, who are all, you know, big sports fans, and our lead editor is a Celtics fan, and he was just, I mean, so in tune with just finding those gems, you know, the crowd, the environment, the atmosphere, the venues, the rivalries, the intensity of the fans, you know, all of that kind of came to life and in a really special way with the amount of time that we were able to present it.
Donovan, you bring up a really interesting point. It's like, what if some of these things that we, you know, we explore in those earlier episodes happen today? Like Dave Cowens, if he, you know, he takes a leave of absence from the team because he's, you know, yeah, he needed a mental health break. And it would have been received very differently today. I think people would have just taken it like, yeah, that happens now. Athletes are, it's okay for athletes to say, I'm vulnerable in this area, and to just say, hey, I need a couple months to just get my, you know, to get my head straight. And, you know, conversely, like, what Russell dealt with while winning is, you know, I awe is too small of a word, but like, if he's doing all those things in the age of social media, like, is it, I don't know, this is a question I ask, is he taking on more slings and arrows or less? Like, I don't know. We'll never know, but it's really interesting to think about. Same thing with the Landsmark photo. If that's posted on social media, does it have the impact? And I think that's a great question for someone way smarter than me. You know, like, yeah, what are those things? And then seeing the league progress is also fascinating, because these guys went from only having 12-year careers to we're seeing athletes like LeBron still doing what he does at age 40. That didn't happen back then. You know, they're taking commercial flights versus not, and it is cool to see that. And then there's the scary stuff of like these fans, fans storming the court and hitting the players or attacking reps that were unacceptable no matter what era it is. And yeah, there was no security, and the smoking and the drinking and the Boston Garden is all fun to look back on. And I sort of remember it, you know, from my youth. I'm dating myself. It's all really, it's part of what makes doing these things really fun. Because you're just, at once, you're just like, I can't believe it used to be like this. And then you also wonder, like, well, what if these things happen today?
I've been able to learn what you guys learned in doing the project. Is there one thing you want viewers to take away from it after going through it? The one thing you'd want them to share when they're talking about it in their group chats or around the water cooler at work?
Yeah, it's a great question, Donovan. And you know, it's something that I've been thinking about, you know, while we were making it, and even now, like, as I'm seeing it kind of out in the world and people are reacting to it. I think, you know, the Celtics are a very unique and special organization. I'm not saying that from a standpoint of, a fan, or, you know, I'm trying to say this from a perspective of objectively, they are unique. You know, the reverence that the current players and the current organization has for the history and the tradition of the organization, of the city, you know, that idea that tradition and history matter, you know, is somewhat being lost, I think, today. And I really enjoyed it, you know, directing this project, just being able to go back, and it informs where we are going and how we move forward through our lives. Can really, there's so much truth that history can give us. And when you can connect those dots into one cohesive piece of work, one cohesive story, and you can see it so truly and organically through the people who lived it and they told their stories to us, I think that's powerful. And I know I felt it. I hope that you do not need to be a Celtics fan to feel that. And I do think it's important right now in this moment in time to remember where we've been and to better understand where we're going.
Yeah, I know we're short on time. I'll make this succinct. It's twofold. For the Celtic fans, like, be proud of the team you root for all the reasons, not just the banners. Be proud of the players that put on the uniform and, you know, achieve those great things on and off the court, and also be proud of your organization, because that organization did move the needle for the country in terms of social progress. Be proud of that too. And also for Celtic fans, don't be shy in taking a very hard look at your city. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah, you might not like what you see all the time, but again, it's all about progress. Keep moving it forward. And for non-Celtic fans, the takeaway is, like, come into this with an open mind. Don't just say, I'm not turning it on because, like, I can't stand those guys, unless you really, truly understand why you can't stand them. And I challenge anyone to watch the first two episodes and then say, I'm not watching this anymore.
Love that. I appreciate the candor and the time. And lastly, quickly before I let you go, I want to know, because you've started so many great conversations with the series, and this has been one, is Boston a great sports town? I would argue the best in North America. Is it a Celtics town? You mentioned Celtic City. It's very clear in other cities, you know, major cities. Toronto is a Maple Leafs town. Dallas is a Cowboys town. L.A. is a Lakers town. New York is a Yankees town. Is Boston a Celtics town? Can you say that?
I think that it has evolved, Donovan. I think that it as we show in the film, it wasn't for periods of time. I think, and what a luxury to have so many great sports teams, like, in your own city. But no, I think initially they weren't. The Celtics weren't the city's team. But I do think that now that has changed. And it is changing. And even, you know, our executive producer, Bill Simmons, was just talking about how many Celtics fans he sees at, you know, traveling on the road, wearing jerseys in other cities, that it is evolving. It is changing the city. And I'm hoping that this documentary helps people have a better appreciation of a team that has been dominant and important and special in their city, competing with the Patriots and the Red Sox, right, and the Bruins. But yeah, that there's a deeper appreciation. But it has changed, and we did see that, you know, in everything that we, all the archival and the people we spoke with, is it's the Celtics matter more now than they ever have.
Yeah, I agree with that completely, and I'll say this through gritted teeth: Boston is an incredible sports town. They are, and, you know, it would have been fascinating, and, like, we were sort of crossing our fingers, because it would have been a great experiment to be living through in 23, when the Celtics could have made the finals, and it looked like the Bruins, they were the best team in hockey during the regular season, and we're like, what if both make the finals at the same time? Like, we started planning on, like, how we would try to integrate that into the documentary, because that's the thing, like, you know, where would the city's allegiance lie? I think at this moment in time, yes, it is Celtics City. But if the Red Sox come out of nowhere and win 100 games this year, I'm curious to see what happens.
Well, I know that we're better off for this piece of work. And although, you know, the Fleet and the Revolution and the Patriots and the Bruins certainly have legacies of their own and huge fan bases, I don't know if you'd be able to tell the story of the city or the country, or quite frankly, a lot of issues that impact the world through the histories of those franchises. Thank you for taking on this mammoth project. You should be really, really proud of it.
Thank you so much, Donovan. That means a lot. And we're just, thank you for having us on.
Yeah, thank you, Donovan. It means a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Lauren and Gabe for their time and their candor and for the beautiful piece of work. Again, these episodes are coming out week by week, but certainly it is worth a watch. HBO Max doesn't miss, and this series is the latest example of that. Okay, we'll take a break, and we'll transfer from HBO to Netflix. Stay with us.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is the show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that you had the show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. It is the Going Deep podcast, and we're going to go deep once again on Drive to Survive. And in the past, we've had executive producers and showrunners for multiple Box to Box series, including Drive to Survive, on the episode. Different approach this time. We're going to talk to not only an F1 fan, but also a journalist as well. Jonathan Brazeau has watched the entire series. He has recapped it and reviewed it for us here at Sportsnet. You can find that on sportsnet.ca. Hyperlink to that is in the show notes. If you're listening via podcast, if you're listening via radio, well, like, favorite, share, and subscribe to the podcast, and you can find Jonathan's work on sportsnet.ca. But I really, really enjoyed this series, and this is someone who's watched every single minute of all of them. Jonathan enjoyed it as well, but he's got a lot more intel as to why you might enjoy it. So let's go deep on Drive to Survive with Jonathan Brazeau.
How are you feeling?
The sport is tough.
You cannot underestimate the mental pressure.
You have all the eyes on you from the outside.
Nothing to see here.
We are the Kardashians of Formula One.
I look perfect.
So, Jonathan, I love the show, love the series, loved your recap about it. And I think there are three distinct buckets of F1 fans. I was actually talking about this with our managing editor, Evan Rosser, recently. There's the diehard F1 fans that have been here for a long time and certainly will always be that base, which, you know, I would count you in that group. There are the Drive to Survivors, that generation who was introduced to the show via the series, you know, during COVID, needed, you know, to change maybe their viewing habits at times. And now, you know, the base has grown and they're part of that. And there are people like me who their only relationship with the sport is through the show. In fact, I do not even want to know what is happening in real time in season because I do not want it to ruin the show. And that made the start of this season, evidently what happened last season, to me, super fascinating. Before we go into the nuts and bolts of season 7, what do you make of the growing fan base of F1 via Drive to Survive and Box to Box, but also the different ways people are interacting with the sport based off of the show's success?
I think it's just wild and great because for niche sports like that, you're always trying to find a way of how do you hook those people that are sort of in the orbit where they're kind of sort of interested in things, but how do you get them engaged? So you almost kind of have to see it like as if Drive to Survive is its own separate thing where you can hook in those casual fans. And then in the case of what happened with the series, it was just the perfect storm where you had the pandemic, everyone's at home, everyone has Netflix, they need something to binge and watch. Well, Netflix is pretty good at really pushing their own content at you. If you're watching, like, say, Seinfeld reruns, it's like, here, watch Orange is the New Black or watch Drive to Survive. And I think that's what really got a lot of people interested in was just those other storylines that it's not necessarily even the racing itself. It's just those human elements, right? That kind of just makes you think that, okay, like, this is the lifestyle, the rich and famous, they're in Monaco or wherever, but there are still real people behind the cars there. And one of the things that I really liked was when Oscar Piastri is at his first day at work with McLaren and he's trying to get in the doors and it's locked. And it's like, haven't we all experienced that, trying to get into the building and your security card doesn't work? So I think that there's a lot of elements there that just relate to people.
Certainly does. I was watching this and seeing how things unfolded in episode one, and they gave you the drama on multiple levels with multiple people right out of the gate and set the tone for what was going to be a great season. I think, to be honest, episode one of this season might have been the best episode in the series history. Granted, I'm here for the reality show aspect of it, but outside of the visuals of someone on fire jumping out of a car, the thing that I've seen talked about most in various group chats was how episode one played out. There's times watching it, I was thinking Christian Horner's pass card to the Red Bull offices might not work by the end of this episode. What did you make of episode one and how they dealt with, you know, huge news in the sport with various people at the same time?
Yeah, there was so much going on with that episode with Christian Horner. You had the Mercedes-Ferrari drama, tugging war of with Lewis Hamilton. Then you had what happens to Carlos Sainz afterwards. Like, you probably couldn't have put together a better first episode where you're like, all right, you want drama? Here's the drama. And none of it was manufactured by the series at all. Like, they didn't have to stage things. It was just everything's unfolding in real life here, and it was completely crazy to see it, like, even unfold before you get to the first race of the season. So I think it was a very difficult situation that they had to navigate with the whole Christian Horner thing, though, because how much access can you get from him? Because obviously with the lawsuit pending, he's not going to say much, but how do you actually present that in a way that gives it the true story? Because they did kind of hint at some things of what was really going on behind the scenes with Red Bull, almost like there's a civil war brewing there. But that then limits your access, because, as you said, it's a reality show. They need access to all the teams. Like, how far can they push that narrative, right?
It's a great point. And I actually loved, and the show does a real good job of this, them leaving in moments of Red Bull PR talking to him about how they're going to handle situations and whatnot, just to give you the temperature of the room and how people are feeling about things in real time and how producers are trying to, on the fly, figure out what they can and can't ask and how dicey of a situation it was. In terms of what they can and can't show and how they tell that story, I thought it was a very interesting and deliberate choice to not show the texts that were leaked and were in question and was this really secondary story of the investigation for Horner. You were brought into his emotions when you're watching him, you know, in the pit, looking at his phone, you know, reacting, and whether or not, you know, those shots were manufactured, he could have been reacting to, you know, the fact that his dog has to go back to the vet. You felt in the moment like, oh my goodness, this guy's house is crumbling around him. But we didn't see explicitly what we learn lots of journalists and other team principals did see. And if you weren't up to speed like me, you were forced to go on a Google Reddit deep dive to see everything that was disclosed. Why do you think they didn't show you the text in a way that Bravo and Andy Cohen in The Real Housewives of Name Your Favorite City would have certainly showed you the text.
I think that they are balancing that fine line where they don't want to necessarily push it too far in terms of, because they still want to put together the full show. They still want to have teams involved. Like, originally the series was just going to be about Red Bull. Like, even if you go back to season one, it has that early installment weirdness where there's no Mercedes, there's no Ferrari. So I think they don't want to harm any of those partnerships with any of the teams, and they don't want to kind of push those certain buttons. And, you know, from a journalism perspective, you are kind of disappointed that they don't dive a bit deeper into that sort of things. But it's one of those things where, you know, for this, for from their perspective, you kind of understand why they won't go that far. Like, even another situation is the that came up later in the season they don't touch upon is the drivers were going after the FIA about the swearing ban that's now become a thing where there's a real back and forth between the drivers and the higher ups, and they don't even touch on that at all. So you can sort of see they're trying to stay politically neutral in sort of those situations there.
Yeah, swearing ban, I would argue, probably not great for the show, but certainly is, you know, F1 wants to bring their live broadcast to more and more audiences. You can see where their motivations are. One of the stars of the show and what differentiates it from maybe other sports docuseries are the talking heads, the journalists or former drivers that put things into context. And this show do a great job of moving the story along, connecting from point A to point B, but also adding context so that you fully understand the stakes and the storylines. We've had the driving positions in those talking heads change a bit over time. What do you make of who they utilized this year and how they did?
Well, I've always been a Jensen Button fan, like back when he was a driver. So it was nice to see him kind of get into it, especially since when he's talked about Lando Norris, because he's been that guy. He, in fact, raced for McLaren, too. So he knows what it's like to have nicknames that aren't very flattering. Like back in the day, he got accused of being like a playboy, a bit lazy, not really focused and motivated on winning. So he kind of understands when drive that gets thrown back at other drivers. And just sidebar there, Button did end up winning the world championship, so he kind of proved people wrong there. So I thought it was interesting to bring him in the mix. And this past season, there was a lot more Will Buxton than I noticed. And I think Will does a great job as just kind of simplifying things for people who don't necessarily follow the sport. Like for people who do are the hardcore, they're going to roll their eyes whenever he says something like, qualifying is so important because it sets the order for the race. But you know, some people might not know that. So it's important to have that kind of injection into things too. And also I like having Claire Williams there because she used to be in charge of things at the Williams team. So she has that perspective too, especially since the team principals and the CEOs are also kind of have these characters too on the show. It's not just the drivers, right?
Yeah, and in fact, I always find myself thinking, I can't believe the team principals are saying that. Not even in the candid things that they're saying while mic, some of the things that they're saying to camera. I just think, could I imagine name your favorite baseball manager, NFL coach, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, certainly not anyone in the sport of hockey saying these things that candidly, and it's just wild. I know I have
To inject in that, go back into the episode where Toto Wolff is talking about Max Verstappen, and if count up how much that would cost in NBA tampering fines, because like it seems in the NBA a GM so much as makes eye contact with another guy, that's a $50,000 fine, right?
Magic Johnson was on late night talk shows getting fined about talking about NBA stars. So yeah, certainly what Toto did would have passed that threshold. I know what mine is, but for you, what was the piece of sound that you heard this year that really, you know, had your ears perk up and maybe got you at the edge of your seat?
Oof. That's a good question. I think that the one that I liked the best was when they brought in Flavio Briatore from Alpine, who he was this guy that, like, back in the day, he helped win world championships with Michael Schumacher, with Fernando Alonso, but he also was involved in what was known as Crashgate, which allegedly he made one of his other drivers crash the car deliberately in order to win a race. So he was banned from the sport for life, later reinstated. So this guy's a character. Like, they showed back in the day when he's hanging around with supermodels like Heidi Klum and Naomi Campbell. So this was a guy that I'm like, all right, here's a character that the casual fans really need to see. So when he came in and he's talking to the new driver, Jack Doohan, and he says, "I control you every millimeter," I'm like, okay, we have our new super villain of the series here. So it was that moment where he's like, "I control you every millimeter." And you're just like, you know, if you have the subtitles on, that's when it's like ominous music playing, right?
I love the subtitles. And also, did not leave me convinced that he wouldn't have a driver crash on purpose in order to make sure his other driver won a race. So for me, the most revealing sound was Lewis Hamilton and Carlos Sainz, and they're, you know, in front of the media on one of the, you know, multiple racer daises, and just having a what they thought was quiet moment to themselves. And Lewis is inquiring on what Carlos's options are and who he's hearing from, and wondering if he's heard from Toto, and Carlos reveals that no, he hasn't called, and so he's probably not interested. Again, this real vulnerable moment that we get to peer into. And then when he asks Lewis for his feedback, and it's fascinating again because Carlos in many ways is in this position because of Lewis. If he believed that Mercedes was going to be able to repair their reputation, get back on top, Lewis says no. And Lewis has to drive for that team and drive that car for another essentially full season. I found that to be so fascinating. You have maybe the strongest partnership in the modern day era of the sport. When you think of Lewis, you think of Mercedes and vice versa. And he's telling another driver, didn't even have, you know, the audacity to lie to him, just said, yeah, no, I don't believe they'll get back top. That must have been crushing if you're Toto to watch back with the rest of us.
Yeah, I love those moments where it's kind of like, oopsie, caught on camera, as opposed to like the setup moments, like when you had Zach Brown in Slovenia meeting his friend, Andrej Kopitar. It's like, come on. It's Kopitar. Give the man some respect. Two-time Stanley Cup champion, captain of the Kings, but you've reduced him to Zach Brown's friend here. But those setup moments where it's like, oh, so what did you do at the last race? And it's like, I'd rather see some of those more kind of candid moments, like in when they were in Singapore and they show how George Russell was reacting after the race. Because growing up as a hardcore racing fan, a lot of people kind of dismiss racing as easy. It's, you know, anyone can do it. But then you see how much it takes a toll on the drivers. Like, George was saying he lost 4 kilograms in weight, and he's like totally dehydrated. He's in the tub afterwards, and even then he's still shaking, very ill. And I like seeing those moments where you just see how vulnerable they are.
I love those as well. The courtship of drivers is so fascinating. I think to me, that aspect of the series every year is more interesting than the actual showcasing of the race for the, you know, Constructors' Championship or you know, who got pole in one city or the next. Was there anything you learned about the courtship and the jockeying for seats last year coming into this season that you didn't maybe necessarily know beforehand?
I guess with just the whole Carlos Sainz thing and just how much of that was a domino effect where the other drivers were like, all right, Carlos Sainz somewhere, because he was basically the guy that everyone was targeting. And it's, as we saw in the episode where you had Williams after him, you had the Sauber team after him, you had Alpine after him. Meanwhile, you have all these other drivers there like, okay, we can't proceed until he signs first, because it's a domino effect sort of thing. So I thought that was fascinating that so many teams were just honed in on one guy, that as soon as that happened, then it was just the floodgates open and everyone else was like, all right, we'll grab this guy sort of as a second hand, that we're like, okay, he might not be our number one pick, but he's still good enough kind of thing.
I had secondhand embarrassment. I was uncomfortable. I was sweating. When the Williams team is getting the champagne on ice and getting the hotel room ready, and he's going to come and he's going to sign. He doesn't show. And it was just, when he eventually signs, it's produced.
Oh, yeah, that moment where it's like you think he's going to see Flavio. He's walking down the hallway. Flavio's ready. He opens the door and it's not Flavio.
Yeah, just brilliant production. But when he initially, you know, I suppose, I can't say snubs because he ended up getting there, but delays Williams was painful, especially because you're hearing the phone conversations amongst the Williams team and how confident they are that he is going to sign. And you're just thinking, oh, man, you weren't thinking because you knew what happened, but I was thinking watching it, oh, man, is this a chance where, you know, producers is setting them up to look foolish and fail? All right, yeah. When we look at the other sports that have started to do these series in the wake of F1 having such great commercial and pop culture success with them, name a sport: gymnastics, tennis, golf, in basketball. It seems like every other sport is getting their version of Drive to Survive. Do you think there have been any series that rival the types of intrigue and access that we're getting from Drive to Survive? And do you think the marketplace might be becoming oversaturated?
Yeah, I think Full Swing is a good one. But again, that's through Netflix. So I think when you see IndyCar did one, but you kind of had to go out of your way to see it. So I think that's the big difference, is in terms of how people are able to gain access to things. Like, as I said earlier, with Drive to Survive, is on Netflix. It was happened when people needed something to watch. And you also had a super hot season on the track too, with at the time Lewis Hamilton versus Max Verstappen. So it just created the perfect scenario for something like that to breed. And I don't fault other sports trying to go out and trying to mimic that, because as we've seen, it's not so much the product that you're creating, but it's trying to create something that highlights those dramatic outside stories that would bring in sort of the casual fans. So I think that, as I mentioned, the Full Swing series does a good job with that, and we'll just see, like, will it run its course? Who knows? It's, people still need to watch something, right?
They definitely do, and they certainly,
there's no shortage of drama.
That's right, and they'll definitely be watching this series next year after what's happened in this season. Obviously early days, but are there any storylines, any happenings from this season that you think will be front and center when we're talking about the next season of Drive to Survive?
Well, I definitely think that how will Lewis Hamilton's first season go at Ferrari, especially since, with how does Charles Leclerc feel about things? Because they don't mention in the show, but he had actually signed a contract extension days before Lewis made his big announcement. So imagine him going from, all right, I signed my contract extension, I'm the number one guy, and then 3 days later, oh, we got Lewis Hamilton. So I think that's probably something that will percolate throughout the season. And then there's also what's going on with McLaren, because as we saw on the show, they established order where Lando Norris is number one going down the stretch there. Oscar Piastri wouldn't be too happy about being number two, but now you have this new season. Is it a clean slate? Are those orders still in place? So that's something that I'm interested to see, as well as with Red Bull, what happens with them now? They're no longer the reigning constructors champion. Does Can Max Verstappen go for five in a row? Like, is there something wrong with the car? What's going to happen there?
You talk about that order, and that was a narrative in this season discussing, can you have two number one drivers, or do you need to have a clear pecking order to make all of those in-race decisions and the race management very simple and everyone is on the same page? Lewis Hamilton goes to Ferrari and makes godly amounts of money in doing so. And so clearly, commercially, both for him and Ferrari, he's of interest. But if you're Charles, you can point to the standings over the last couple of years and say, I am, as of now, the more in-form driver. Can he be clearly the number one? Can you have Lewis Hamilton driving a car and not be the number one? How do you think that's going to be handled?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're paying him enough money to be the number one guy. I think that it's just going to be a situation where just let the guys race. Like, see who emerges as the number one guy and then figure things out. And that's probably what they're going to have to do, because both of them are quite capable of winning races. So it'll be interesting to see how that all unfolds.
Well, Lewis Hamilton just wants to race, and evidently he wants less feedback while he's racing. You know the sport better than I, and Lewis has said some of the coverage of that is over-scrutinized, given the fact that Max Verstappen and his ongoing relationship with his team and the type of feedback, or some would say abuse, that he provides isn't covered. Story or non-story for you?
I think it is a story, because it's just how different they are as people. Even like Max Verstappen is a very fiery individual. He really wears his emotions on his sleeve. If something's not going right, he just takes it to that 11th degree where he'll be yelling on his radio like crazy. But for Lewis, he's kind of a bit more calm, but he's still driven, determined. I mean, that's why he went to Ferrari in the first place, right? He didn't think he could win another championship with Mercedes. He wants to win that eighth championship. As he said in the season before, he wants to reclaim his eighth. He feels he was robbed of that championship from the previous season, and he's just determined to go out and do it. He is, pun intended, he's driven to do what it takes in order to win.
Yeah, it seems like that eighth, and the way it ended, which, you know, some felt ended that way to manufacture a scenario because of the lust for storylines and Drive to Survive, seems to be haunting him in the way that Serena Williams not getting, her historic championship against Naomi Osaka and chasing it afterwards seemed to haunt her at the end of her career. Lewis, a busy guy, and before I let you go, he's part of the team that's bringing us an F1 movie, not a documentary, but along with Warner Brothers and Apple and Brad Pitt, a movie about F1 that many people are really excited for. I would argue that part of the reason why this movie even exists is because of the success of Drive to Survive and thus F1, especially in North America, over the last couple years. What are you expecting from this film, and are you looking forward to it?
I'm looking forward to it because I obviously will love to watch anything that's F1 related, but I think it's going to just follow kind of the Top Gun narrative where you have the veteran guy, the up and coming, how are they going to get along? So I think the storyline might be a bit cliched, but I think it's going to be very visually appealing. As I said, like Top Gun, it's going to be a blockbuster film that you're just going to want to see how it all unfolds.
Well, I can't wait. With, less and less people going to watch things in theaters, when you think of the noise and the shots and the speed, seeing that on a big screen would be super fascinating. We're fascinated about all things F1 now. As we let you go, let us know where we can find your continued coverage of the sport for Sportsnet.
Well, just go to sportsnet.ca/autoracing, where you'll find all my takeaways and other storylines and previews.
Awesome. Can't wait. Really appreciate it. Loved the season. Watched it once, probably watch it again with my wife, as she's a slow binger, I'm a fast binger. But now I get to watch it again through new eyes with much more context, because you provided some great insight. Cheers.
Thanks so much, Donovan.
That's it for me. Thank you so much for listening. Please, once again, like, favorite, share, subscribe, and go watch again. Both of these docuseries are really, really good. They are not just sports series. So if you're not into basketball or the Celtics, if you're not into auto racing or F1, if you're not into sports, I'm telling you, it doesn't matter. Both of these are entertaining, educational, and worth the disposable time that you have to give them. Evidently, you listened this deep into this podcast, so you felt the same about it. Thank you. That means a lot. Talk soon.